was in probably the summer of 1951. And what was interesting, the 1st Battalion, Royal 22nd Regiment, was airborne. It wasn't slated for Korea for about a year or 8 months. And Eddie Burkowski had been a sergeant in Rivers, I had been a corporal in Rivers, and Frank Jeffries had been a corporal in Rivers, so we're all airborne trained. And so that we started running the airborne training program for the Royal 22nd Regiment in Quebec City, because they had very few officers, their company commanders. The battalion had been stripped of junior officers to send another battalion, the 3rd Battalion, Vandusium, to Korea. And they just had company commanders, and the colonel left almost. And some of the company commanders were captains when they should have been commanded by majors. And so we were running most of the airborne training and having great fun jumping when we were hauled off all this and sent to Laval University. And about the third day of the course, we were sitting there learning our French verbs. And the orderly officer came upstairs, and he said, Lieutenants Goodman, Burkowski, and Jeffries, the adjutant of the 1st Battalion wants to see you. And we had been planning on an airborne exercise in Fort Churchill that winter, and we were the only three, really, we were more airborne qualified than any of the other officers, and I thought that we were going up to Churchill to do a reconnaissance because we had been sort of planning on this. And so just for a joke, I said, oh, where are we going, Korea? And he said, yes. The teacher, who was a lady, broke into tears that three of her pupils were going off to fight for democracy. The three of us were flabbergasted. And we had just moved there. I had just moved into a house, just signed a year's lease for a house. My wife was newly pregnant. It was just incredible. Anyway, that's what we became commissioned for, and so we went and saw the adjutant of the 1st Battalion, says we were being posted to the 2nd Battalion, Royal Vandusium Regiment, in Korea, and that we're leaving in 30 days. So I went and broke my lease, and my furniture hadn't even been delivered from Fredericton to Quebec City. And so we got a hold of the moving company and told them to send it back to Fredericton. And I climbed in my car and drove my wife down to Fredericton, and I came back a couple weeks later. And we then took off by train to Edmonton. Edmonton was a holding unit for Korea reinforcements. And then from Edmonton, they needed us in a hurry. They flew us by Dakota across the Rockies, which was interesting. And then by Canadian Pacific Air, charter aircraft, Canadian Pacific Air, luxury flight from Vancouver to Tokyo. And then by train from Tokyo to Curie, which was the Canadian reinforcement unit in Japan. Very interesting flight, troops well behaved, and no problems all the way. And when we got into Japan, it was one of those old things, you hurry up and wait, and they decided they didn't need us in such a hurry and that we should be retrained. And so we went to a small training camp just outside of Curie at a place called Haramura. And in Haramura, we did some battle training, and this time it was particularly advantageous, having been in the Second War, where I was able to set up a realistic battle drill training course there. And then we moved from there, which was an individual type of training there.
Could you maybe go into that, expand a little
bit? Sure. In Nippon Bara, it was individual training, where we were training people to fire their own weapons, throw grenades, and in emergency handle battalion weapons. And most of it was on the range. We trained people, we had never seen a 60 millimeter mortar before, which was an American weapon. We had always used a 2-inch mortar in Canada. We had not used the 81 millimeter mortar before, because we'd used the 3-inch mortar in Canada. The anti-tank weapon was the bazooka, whereas we had all been trained on Piats. The grenades were British grenades, and we still had our Lee Enfield rifles, so the rifles was no change. The Bren guns we were still using, but we now trained on the American 30 caliber Browning, which is an air-cooled belt machine gun, and had a familiarization of the 50 millimeter. Wasn't 50 millimeter. It's 0.50 millimeter. 50 caliber Browning, which was used in any tank, although we used it as an anti-personnel weapon. It also was used anti-aircraft, but we used it as an anti-personnel weapon in Korea. It also learned American mines and so on. So it was an individual training, type of training there. And then we moved from there to Nihonbara, which was up near Suiyama in central Japan, and that was a small unit training type, so that people were trained in platoon and section tactics as a member of a team rather than as individuals. And I guess we spent about 2 months there, not 2 months, heck no, month there, I guess. And it was quite delightful. Nihonbara, Suiyama, the town, was way up in the mountains of central Japan, and lots of people there had never seen a white man before. Never seen before. There were no Americans around, no British. It was strictly a Canadian camp, and it was really interesting. And I really enjoyed that portion of Japan.
You were well received.
Very well received. People very polite. And we would go downtown in the evenings and go into a little Japanese drinking establishments, and it was just a delight. Much different than Kure, which was a Commonwealth camp, where there was lots of Allied or Commonwealth soldiers and lots of Canadians, or in other towns where there was a lot of Americans as well. And they had been there, of course, since the war, and so this was 5 years, 4 to 5 years after the Second War had finished. And from there, we suddenly got a rush call and needed us right away. And off we went to Korea. We flew to Korea in Dakotas and landed in Seoul, taken by truck to a Canadian reinforcement depot, which was about 30 miles behind the lines. And then the next day, the transportation from our regiments brought us up.
How did you feel going into action again?
That was a strange feeling, and I don't often talk about that because I had a lot of apprehension. I had a very tough Second War, and I felt I really did well to survive it. And I wasn't particularly keen about being shot at again. And so if somebody had said to me, okay, you can fight your war in Japan, I would probably have jumped at it. But it was with a great deal of apprehension that I went forward. I was given a platoon in A Company of the 3rd Battalion, Royal 22nd Regiment. Sorry, that came later. I ended up, the battalion was out of the line for a rest, and we had not as few officers as we had been led to believe, and so I was posted as the second in command of the mortar platoon. The mortar platoon is commanded by a captain, and the second command is a lieutenant. And we were out of the line at the time, which was very interesting. My first command wasn't really a command. We had a captain doing it. His name was Charlie Forbes, French-speaking, though, from Quebec. And we were not greeted very well by the French-speaking officers, particularly the company commanders. The battalion commander was non-committal. He didn't have much choice. If he wanted officers, he had to take us. Well, all I have to do is look at the time. It was there. It was Colonel Gaston Vallée. So I'd like to tell you about an amusing incident and the unreasonableness of some people. The commanding officer... first of all, we had a movie in the officer's mess each night. And the officer's mess was a big marquee tent. And this was set up on top of a bunker that would hold just about everybody who could get into a marquee. So the floor was big logs, which became the roof of the bunker underneath. So if we were shelled, then everybody would leave the tent and go down underneath the bunker. But we had a movie in there every night. And of course there was a bar. And people from time to time would get up and go outside to relieve themselves, as was their wont. And during the break of the movie, because it was just one projector, and when they're changing reels, the colonel went to go outside, and he couldn't find his flashlight. And so he was furious. And people offered to lend him one. He didn't want one. He wanted his flashlight. His flashlight was very distinctive because it had tape wrapped around the thing so that nobody would take the colonel's flashlight. And
what is this leading to?
So the colonel came back in after going out stumbling around in the dark. He wouldn't take anybody else's flashlight. He said, "Stop the movie. Until I get my flashlight, there will be no more movies." And so stormed out. Well, we searched that place high and low for his flashlight, and it wasn't there. And so we all boozed up and straggled back to our own tents. And during the night, I was sharing a tent with the platoon commander, Charlie Forbes. During the night, I had to get up and have a pee. So I had to get up sometime during the middle of the night to have a pee. And between Charlie Forbes' cot and mine, the little safari cots, there was a ration box that had our flashlights on it and so on. So I reached out, grabbed a flashlight, and out I went to have a pee. And we were right beside a great big reservoir. And I looked at the flashlight as I was draining the dew off my lily, and by golly, it was the colonel's flashlight. Charlie had been drunk and had inadvertently picked up the colonel's flashlight. So I took that flashlight and I heaved it out into the center of that reservoir as far as I could. Left it on, and you could see the light sort of disappeared down and finally dimmed. And I wound my way back to the tent, went to sleep. Forgot about it. Next night we went down to the officer's mess, and by golly, the colonel came in and was looking for his flashlight. No flashlight, no movie. So we all boozed it up again. And for the rest of the time we were out of the line, which was about four more days, no movies. We even took a flashlight and wound tape, a same flashlight, exactly the same. It was just an issue of flashlight. Took the same and we wound tape around it, exactly the same as was his. They looked it all over. And we could see him examining this thing by the bar. "That is not my flashlight. I want my flashlight." By golly. It was just like Captain Queeg on the... What was that movie?
Oh, that was...
It was Mr. Robert.
Yeah.
With the captain... It wasn't Queeg. It was the captain who had the palm tree on the bridge. Exactly the same kind of type of an incident. And so that didn't give me a great deal of confidence in my colonel. I was then sent from the mortar platoon. They decided that me platoon commanders in A Company. And I joined A Company as the commander of number 3 platoon. And when we went back into the line, we went back up into the line and down along the Samichon Valley. and I was in a company commanded by a Major Vandalak. Now, the Korean force was recruited from the dregs of people, in many cases, who weren't making a go of it between the Second War and the Korean War. Some people had almost been escorted there to join the army by local police forces, and so there were a lot of hard nuts. And this chap was a boozer, my company commander. His total action, he had wore a military cross, but his total action in the Second War was 9 hours at Dieppe, where he had been captured, and had then spent the war there, got out of the army at the end of the war, and now was back in with no training and sent to Korea as a platoon, as a company commander. No wonder he had a drinking problem. The colonel would phone me up at night as a second lieutenant and say, "Lieutenant, is your company commander drunk again?" And what am I going to say as a second lieutenant? I'd say, "Well, sir, I haven't been over to company headquarters." And he'd say, "If anything happens tonight, you're in charge." Well, what was I supposed to do? It didn't give me a lot of confidence in my platoon commander, or my company commander. And finally, poor old Major Vandalak was sent back to Canada. Actually, he was a very nice person, and he did have a good war record so far as it went, and it wasn't his fault that he was placed in a position where he couldn't exercise command. I understand in later years he dried out, he doesn't drink now, and he's now the Master at Arms in the House of Commons. Another one.
Very interesting.
Yeah, he really was a nice person. He just had a drinking problem and was placed in a job which he couldn't do. He didn't know how to fight a company. He hadn't been in a company since 1942. So this was 9 years later. And probably, how much tape have we got left there?
We got lots of tape.
All right. We're in the line at that time, I guess, for about 3 months. Our days were mostly taken in sleeping, digging and improving our trenches. We were in trenches on the crest of hill overlooking a very wide valley, the Samichon River Valley, and so that the Chinese were at least a mile, if not 2 miles, away from us, beyond small arms fire. Unfortunately, our nights were taken up in patrolling. And the Korean War at this time, this would be very early in 1952, January, February, March, April 1952, were taken up in patrolling. And it was a tough war on lieutenants and corporals and some sergeants. A corporal would take a listening post out at night, a corporal and two men, and go way out in the valley and just sit there all night long and come back. It was very difficult on the nerves. Every once in a while, one of these outposts would get shot up. A platoon commander or lieutenants or sergeants would take up fighting patrols, and the mere whisper of 1 in 10 was enough to send shivers through the sergeants and officers, because 1 in 10 meant that there was a patrol of 10 men and one officer, and that meant a fighting patrol. And you never knew what to expect. We would take these men out, go across the valley, and find the Chinese lines and try to capture a prisoner or to probe around, find out where the trenches went to, because they, like us, occupied some trenches in the daytime and other trenches at night. The valley was rice paddies. There was a river, the Samichon River, which was semi-frozen. And I remember one night being called on the radio as I'd crossed the Samichon River and hadn't found any Chinese, the place I was sent, and was coming back, and I was through the ice of the river and up to my waist, and I was carrying the radio, and the company commander, drunk or sober, said, "Where are you? Are you near the river?" And my reply was, I'm in the fucking river." And so then I got shit from the colonel because I swore over the radio the next day. It wasn't a very pleasant way. I had. We would take out a patrol, I guess, a fighting patrol. There are 9 platoon commanders, and so that. Sorry, 4 companies of 3. 12 platoon commanders. So that meant every 12th night, you were the guy if they took it in rotation, and they usually did. And it was very, very hard on the nerves. I was lucky or unlucky, as the case may be, is that all my patrols I took out were uneventful, and that I never did run into any Chinese in the places where I was sent. We just didn't go across. We would be sent to some point to ask a specific question or to find whether there's any Chinese there, and if there was, then to shoot them up a bit and probably withdraw or come back. The usual thing was to try to get a prisoner.
Were the other patrols successful or no, unsuccessful?
No.
Or
usually what would happen is that any action, one of our patrols would be ambushed on the way back. And that was very bad news to run into an ambush on the way back, coming back to your lines. And we did lose some people that way.
Were the Chinese sending out patrols as well?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And so that meant at nights, they were all sleepless nights, because the Chinese would come up to our lines and probe as well. Now, I suppose that it was very close to World War I type warfare, except that we were much farther away in this particular point, because it took such a long time to get over there and such a long time to come back again. And so you wanted to be back in before dawn. And they had the same problem, of course. Their field craft was excellent. We were probed one night, and I figured that they must have been up to our wire by dusk, that they must have moved up during the daylight, and nobody saw them. And then at dusk, all hell broke loose. And in front of my platoon, there was at least 7 double aprons of barbed wire, which would take up about 28 feet. Between my the one closest to the enemy, and the next one, there were mines. I had booby traps in the wire, so if somebody grabbed the wire, then the booby traps would explode. I had fugas rigged up, which was an illegal type of thing, but we had to occupy our mine some way. And that was a 45-gallon drum of napalm with the end of it cut out, and just a plug put in over the end to cover it over, plastic over the end, and a charge in the back of it, and lines running from electrical detonator back to my platoon headquarters, me and my sergeant and runner, platoon headquarters position. And what I would do is I'd put that on my telephone, take my telephone, disconnect my telephone, put that on my telephone, crank the telephone. That would put electrical charge in the wires. This would go explode, go boom, and would throw out 45 gallons of napalm down the side of the hill. Beautiful. Very spectacular. And I also had bazooka bombs. They came in a tin canister, so I cut the ends out of each of the canisters, put the bazooka bombs in, took the pin out, safety pin out, and then aimed them places where I thought the Chinks might come up attacking my platoon, aimed them, put sandbags on top of them, put telephone wires onto those, put them back, and then you just crank the telephone, whoosh, off would go a Piat bomb. Lovely.
Where did you get these ideas?
I just sneaky, that's all. And they worked like a charm. And they're strictly illegal, of course. And in my platoon headquarters fighting pit, which was right in between my 2 forward sections, I could sit there and I could crank these things off to my heart's content. And they were really very effective. And the one really serious attack during this time, the Chinese came roaring up. And I suppose there must have been, I don't know how many, how many people are in a horde, we used to say, you know. The newspapers would report hordes of Chinese. We never really could figure out how many were in a horde, but anyway, lots of them. And they carried rice mats. When they came up to the wire, they would throw these rice mats up. And the rice mats would come up over top of our double aprons of wire, and then they'd run up over top of the rice mats. Really very effective, but it took a lot of courage on their part to stand there and throw these bloody rice mats, because all our fire was interlocking fire. And we had lots of ammunition. There was never any shortage of small arms ammunition. And my 60mm mortars were all sighted in all these places, and we had pounded the blazes out of them. And they must have taken a lot of casualties, a real lot of casualties. We never went out in there, principally because of the mines. We took over this position from the British. They had put in mines, we had put in mines, and sometimes platoon commanders, who are not very fussy about going out in front of their wire, aren't particularly careful about where they register their minefields. And so nobody wanted to go out in that area, so we never went out in that particular area just to find. But there's a lot of stink coming from there.
I would think so, yeah.
And so most of the time was taken up in that type of activity. And this lasted from about January to March. January, February, April, March, April. Perhaps into April. The weather in January had been terrible, with very cold weather, not very pleasant. And it was very barren. The river was frozen, the rice paddies frozen. And then spring was really very beautiful and very nice weather. We were living in dugouts, very similar to World War II dugouts. World War I dugouts, rather, with heavy timbers across the top of them. And some of them became very fancy. The shelling, by World War II standards, was nothing more than harassment. My platoon, on an average day, would take three or four shells. On a bad day, we might get a couple dozen in. So the shelling was very minimal. I even had my men, to occupy their time in the daytime, level off a bit back of the hill, and they put up a volleyball net in the volleyball field in back of the hill. It couldn't be seen from the other side. But I never at any time felt insecure of having people playing volleyball in the daytime. At that time, the battalion, the 3rd Battalion, the 2nd Battalion, Royal 22nd Regiment, rather, was due to go home, and I had only been in Korea for 4 months or 5 months, and so the platoon commanders being excess, and the battalion coming over to relieve them, the 1st Battalion, Royal 22nd Regiment, had all their officers. So we were asked what we would like to do. And I said that I would like to go to an operational headquarters to learn more about my profession, in particular, thinking it would be interesting. And it was. I was posted as a liaison officer, the junior liaison officer, with the Commonwealth Division headquarters. The Commonwealth Division was organized of Canada, which had a brigade, Australia, which had a battalion, and two British battalions in the brigade, but it was commanded by an Australian brigadier, and their supporting artillery in that brigade were New Zealanders, and also a British brigade, a British battalion. The Commonwealth Division was commanded by a British general, and the staff were from all the Commonwealth countries, including South Africa. And so I learned an awful lot in the 3 months which I spent there as a liaison officer. For much of the time I was the liaison officer with the 1st American Marine Division, and I traveled over there at least once a week, often twice a week. And the highlight of that particular job was when I was taken by them on an assault landing on an island off the coast of Korea, a place called To Chot Do. And it was my first real chance to observe without being a part of or having any responsibilities of an assault landing. It was a textbook one, which would Marines like to practice. They took over an island which had been a North Korean listening post, and they did it as an exercise as well as an operational, as well as an operation, just for the experience. And I was also the liaison officer with the American 45th Division for a short period of time in the 1st Republic of Korea Division. My job was to take messages from our own divisional headquarters, which couldn't go by radio or any other way, to them, and to bring information back, to study their maps, make sure that the liaison points between the Commonwealth Division and our neighboring divisions were set up, and so that contact points would be set up so that patrolling would take place in between the two divisions without any problems of people shooting each other up. But generally it was information brought back for the operational staff from our neighboring divisions. I found it a very interesting, very challenging job. My driver was a New Zealander who was a Maori, and really a very interesting person, well-educated, well-spoken, and we became very good friends. Also, I was expected to take my turn as duty officer in the operations section of the Commonwealth Division headquarters, and the general GSO2, who is the person in charge of the operations center, was a Major R.C.W. Thomas, who had written the book Staff Duties in the Field, and was just loved teaching people. If people were interested in learning, he would take hours and hours to teach people organization and staff duties. And that was to stand me in good stead many years later as I qualified for higher rank. And I placed most of it that very firm grounding that he gave me there. We had British officers, a Canadian G3, an Australian liaison officer, a New Zealand liaison officer. There was no Indian on the operational staff. There was an Indian on the intelligence staff, which we worked very closely with, and a South African on the intelligence staff, who we worked very closely. The GSO1 was a Canadian post, as was the senior medical officer, a Canadian post. And so you can see that it was really a headquarters which will probably never ever happen again, of that type of thing. And it was very, very interesting, and for myself very instructive. The 1st Battalion finally had some casualties, and they asked for me back again, and I went back to the 1st Battalion, Royal Vandusian Regiment, and was posted as a platoon commander in C Company. I went forward and into the company quite happy. They were much the same type of soldiers. I had a very good company commander, and they had been there about 3 months by this time, and so had sort of settled down. And they were in the line up on the left of the RCR up near Hill 355, and they were on Hill number 210, Hill 210. And it was much the same as my previous 4 months in the line of patrolling and at night and working on trenches in the daytime. Very little shelling. And but this time one of the companies was short a company second in command, and so the commanding officer asked me if I'd like to be a company 2IC, even though I was a second lieutenant, because the company 2IC was a Captain Colasar, and who became a friend of mine later. And he said Mike had no combat experience, and so he became a platoon commander as a captain, and I became a company second in command as a second lieutenant, which was a very strange thing to do, rank-wise, but practicalities, it was a wise thing to do. And I know it stood Mike in good turn later, although he took a lot of razzing from some of his fellow officers. And so my job now was back in A echelon, which is immediately behind the lines, to make sure that my company was supplied with rations and ammunition, and that I supervised the administration of the company. The company commander was really a fantastic guy by the name of Captain Harry Pope,
His father had been Major General Pope, who had been Minister of Defense, I believe, or he had been a cabinet minister, I believe, in the First War as a Major General. And he was a very smart and clever person. And he said, okay, if you're going to be the second in command of the company, you'll be that in all respects, regardless of Captain Colasar's platoon commander. And a measure of his trust, I really appreciate it, when Harry went on R&R to rest and relaxation to Tokyo, I became second in command, and I fought the company for that 1 week period as the company commander. And I really respected that trust that had been placed in me. And it was very interesting, and they also, Mike deserved a lot of credit as a captain to be under my command, as did one of the other platoon commanders who was a full lieutenant. Again, my days that week that I commanded the company were taken up with sending out patrols and